Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Wednesday, April 17th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm speaking today with Manny Fabian and Sue Sirks. Hi there. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. It is day 194 of the war. The IDF said it carried out a wave of airstrikes against Gaza terror targets over the last day as the U.S. and Europe pledged to increase the sanctions on Iran. And Israel, meanwhile, is being pressed to forget about its threatened retaliation. There was a commando who was seriously injured as Israeli tanks pushed into northern Gaza. We'll talk about that, as well as IDF strikes in the north and clashes in the West Bank on three different fronts. We'll also talk about a controversial climate bill, a first reading of which was passed in the Knesset, a very long-delayed shipment of livestock that finally arrived at the Haifa port, and a planned skyscraper in Jerusalem. All of that in today's podcast after a quick break.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Okay, Manny, let's update our listeners about what's happening on all of these three fronts. Let's start with Gaza, where there seems to be a slight push of sorts into northern Gaza, where a commando was seriously injured. Tell us about what's happening there.
So right now in the Gaza Strip, there are two main operations that are being carried out. The army considers them pinpoint operations, not a major offensive yet. The one we've talked about before is going on in central Gaza on the outskirts of Nuseirat. It's just south of Gaza City. That has been going on for more than a week now, and that's where most of the fighting is taking place. And then recently, just the beginning of this week, the army launched a new operation in Beit Hanun, which is very close to the Israeli border near Sderot. Yesterday there were reports that Israeli tanks had pushed in a little bit further into Beit Hanun and into Jabalia as well, which is nearby. During the operation in Beit Hanun, that's where a member of the Shaldag unit was seriously wounded. According to Hamas, they had shot the soldier with sniper fire. That is as much information as we know right now, but that is where the two main operations are being carried out. The army says that in central Gaza, it managed to locate and destroy rocket launchers that were primed for attacks on Israel, and carried out many other strikes against Hamas positions, tunnels, buildings where terror operatives were gathered. So that's where the two main operations are being carried out. I'll note that the army is currently in the process of calling up two reserve brigades, for future operations in Gaza. They will be deployed to the operations that are currently being carried out. That includes also the Netzarim corridor, which splits Gaza. We've talked about this before, where there's a road that basically crosses Gaza from the Be'eri area to the coast. That's where these troops will be deployed into other ongoing missions. And the soldiers that are currently in Gaza will be withdrawn in order to get a small break, and then they will then be prepared for future operations, larger operations, including Rafah, which we've talked about as well, which is looming and will be carried out at some point soon.
I know just from conversations with, you know, various friends, neighbors, community people, that there's quite a lot of reservists who are sort of on the border with Gaza, ready to go in and not getting off for Pesach, for Passover. So I'm assuming that's part of what we're speaking about here. They're sort of sitting there in bases and in areas near Gaza? Any sense of that?
Yeah, so there are a lot of preparations now for Rafah and for other more large-scale operations in Gaza right now. In Gaza, there aren't too many troops carrying out these operations. There's only these two small pinpoint raids being carried out. But there are preparations for the Rafah operation. We saw Defense Minister Yoav Gallant hold a meeting a couple days ago with top army officials to discuss the plans how to evacuate the civilians from Rafah. So there are definitely plans that are moving ahead now. There's been a lot of talk about when this Rafah operation will happen, but things are progressing now. We're seeing the army call up reservists. We're seeing Gallant hold these meetings on how to correctly evacuate the population and provide aid to the civilian population in Gaza. So it will be sooner rather than later, I think, this operation.
Okay, now moving north. Israeli fighter jets struck Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. You really just wrote this up in the last, I don't know, half hour or so. Tell us what's going on there and what does this actually mean? What are we actually seeing in the north?
So the north is really this sort of exchange of fire that we've been seeing for the past 6 months is still ongoing. But there has been an uptick in the number of more senior Hezbollah commanders being killed by Israel. So yesterday there were two top commanders who were killed, one of whom was the commander of Hezbollah's coastal region. So he was in charge of all the attacks that come from the from that region, from the coast area on Israel. And then another strike targeted a commander in Hezbollah's Radwan force, which is their elite unit. He was the head of the rocket unit in one of the districts as well. So two senior commanders, both were targeted while driving in southern Lebanon. So Israel had accurate intelligence on where they were exactly while they were driving, and they were hit in separate drone strikes yesterday. Hezbollah has continued to carry out attacks. This morning they launched rockets at the Biranit army base. Yesterday they launched two explosive drones at northern Israel, which exploded near the community of Beit Hillel, injuring three people. According to Hezbollah, they tried to target an Iron Dome battery. As far as I know, there's no damage to any Iron Domes, but it just shows that Hezbollah is still continuing their attacks. Israel, in turn, is still targeting its operatives, including its senior commanders. I think it brings the number to around 30 commanders in Hezbollah who have been killed amid the war. But there are still no prospects of the 60 to 70,000 Israeli civilians who have been evacuated from the northern border of returning. It's just not safe enough to return.
Right. So they're still wherever they are, Airbnbs and hotels and apartments. Okay. Then to the West Bank. More clashes. It does feel like it's noisier and there's more going on there than there had been for a while. Can you describe for us what's going on there as well?
I think since the murder of the Israeli teenager last week, there's been an uptick in violence between, not between soldiers and Palestinians, but rather between Israeli civilians, Israeli settlers and Palestinians. We saw that a few days ago there was clashes near a settlement. According to reports that the army received, a Jewish shepherd had been attacked by Palestinians. That caused some sort of altercation, during which the army showed up for a bit, tried to disperse it, then left. And by the end of it, two Palestinians were killed, according to the army. Troops did not kill these two Palestinians, but rather Israeli civilians did. The police and the army are investigating, but it just shows that there's been quite an uptick. There was, following the murder of Achimeir, there were several attacks by settlers against Palestinian towns and villages, civilians setting fire to homes and cars. It feels like a repeat of what we've seen previously in the West Bank following other terror attacks against Israelis. And it's very difficult for the army to clamp down on this. There's a lot of attention on other fronts, especially in Gaza and Lebanon.
Right. How do you clamp down on that?
There are plenty of troops in the West Bank, more than usual, but that's been the case for the past 2 years. But still, it's there's a lot of attention on other things, especially to locate the murderers behind the attack on the weekend. So it's very difficult for the army to actually manage this. But there are people who are saying, especially human rights groups, who are saying that the army's not doing enough to prevent these attacks. And we've even seen evidence of this, of footage showing Israeli civilians vandalizing Palestinian cars and homes where soldiers are seen nearby and not stopping them or doing them. So it's a problem. There could be more done, but I do think that in general the army has a lot of things to deal with, and it doesn't always have its attention on trying to prevent these sort of attacks.
Right. Not surprising. Okay, Manny, thank you very much for that update. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, Sue will talk to us first about the passage of a first reading of the climate bill. Hold on. Stay with us.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Sue. So the first reading of a climate bill was finally passed, something you've referred to before. But what did it look like?
So it doesn't look like very much, actually. Dozens of countries have climate acts today, and the point of a climate act is to anchor in law targets for cutting global warming gases and for preparing a country for the effects of climate change. Over half of the EU member states, for example, have adopted or in the process of adopting climate laws. Israel took its first step on the ladder earlier this month by passing the first reading of a climate bill. But a lot of people, climate groups, obviously, but also the state controller, say that it's basically not worth the paper it's written on. Idit Salman, who's the Environmental Protection Minister, said that it sets targets and programs for cutting emissions and preparing the economy and what have you. What she didn't say is that basically the finance ministry determined the outlines of this bill. The government will be able to change the targets, change the years they have to be met, change the base year that will serve as the year of comparison. A big role is given in the bill to the finance and energy ministries in the approval of various plans. There's a lot of reference to the need for cost-benefit analyses or economic measurements of climate-related measures, with obviously no reference to the cost of not passing a climate bill or not meeting those targets. And the government will be able to exempt ministries and corporations from any obligation to prepare adaptation plans. Now, last month, a state controller brought out a report, which I think I talked about, and he said that the refusal to anchor targets in law was motivated by a fear of people taking legal action against the government for not meeting the targets. And he said, and that's what most people believe, that even the current targets are very unlikely to be met. We're very, very behind. And he warned that a declarative climate law would just be for show to the world. He said that the drafts that he'd seen at that point had no mechanism for budgeting. Neither does this one. This new bill talks about reducing emissions from 30% by 2030, but we're not going to hit that. So the whole thing is really an exercise in blah, blah, blah.
Presumably, it's just going to pass. It will pass. It passed the first reading, and it will pass because there's not really much to argue about here with this particular government.
Correct. The arguments are over.
Got it. Okay. Moving on. Livestock. 14,000 cows, I would presume, that came from Australia. They are destined for fattening and slaughter here in Israel. They've taken a long time to get here, and they finally arrived at the Haifa port. What can you tell us about that shipment?
What I can tell you is that Israelis, although Israel is known as the vegan, one of the vegan centers of the world, Tel Aviv certainly. Israelis are among the biggest consumers of beef in the world. But the country's so tiny that it doesn't have enough land to grow its own livestock. So most meat is imported, and much of it, sadly, in the form of animals, live animals that are crammed onto multi-deck ships that are brought into the country only to be fattened and slaughtered. This particular ship really set a new record. It's owned by the Israeli Daba company. It took around 3 months to reach Haifa, and that was because of what's going on in the Red Sea with Iranian-backed Houthi terrorists attacking ships. This particular ship set off from Western Australia with 14,000 lambs and 2,000 calves on January the 5th. The ship is apparently designed to carry 8,000 animals. I can see you gawping, exactly. Anyway, on January the 16th, it was diverted from its route through the Red Sea because of fear of attack by the Houthis, and it was recalled back to Australia, arriving in a heat wave on February the 14th. The animals were offloaded and taken to feedlots. Some of them died, by the way. Then around 13,700 of the sheep and 550 calves were reloaded and set sail on March the 3rd, finally arriving on April 6th. Again, some of them died, but according to the Agriculture Ministry, it wasn't a significant percentage. So they're then unloaded, they're taken by truck, piled onto trucks to feedlots where they are fattened and then slaughtered. And all that so that people can enjoy their favourite steak or lamb chops. I personally think it's horrific. Now, in November 2018, the Knesset did pass a preliminary reading of a bill to reduce live shipments and stop them within 3 years and move to chilled meat, which seems much more, I mean, it's not humane, but better than the live shipments. But of course, all of that has stopped. The government's then changed. There were lots of elections. And since then, basically, everybody stopped talking about it.
And here are the livestock of this last shipment. Okay. Now, switching gears to another topic that you often cover, which is development, and particularly in Jerusalem, the city that you used to live in. And here we have the highest skyscraper that's planned in Jerusalem, the Burj Jerusalem, as you're calling it, or it's being called. And that, I want to just say, I'm countering that with another article that we didn't talk about, which is development on Lupine Hill in Jerusalem. So if you could throw those in together, I would really appreciate it.
Oh, I will try. Okay. So the thing is that Jerusalem basically is one massive building site. In terms of the tower, there's a good reason for calling it the Burj. Everyone's heard of the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, the world's tallest building. Jerusalem is going to get its own tallest building, not as high, but very high by Jerusalem standards, 200 meters high, equivalent to around 80 stories. And the reason that people are calling it the Burj is not only because of its height, but because it's been designed by a US firm, one of whose partners led the team that designed the Dubai Burj, albeit he was working for a different company at the time. And as you might expect, this has attracted widespread opposition, mainly because of its location in Western Jerusalem, because it's going to be overlooking, it's on the crest of a high hill. You'll see it from everywhere. It will overlook Yad Vashem, the Mount Herzl Military Cemetery, and the picturesque old village of En Karim. Now, among the many organizations, there's been 200 objections. Among the many organizations that have objected is Yad Lebanim, which represents the families of fallen soldiers. There are something like 2,800 fallen soldiers buried on Mount Herzl. And Yad Lebanim says that it's just adding stress to an already dreadful time for those grieving families, and that it's incredibly insensitive. Another organization that's protesting is the Association of Israeli Architects. And they make a very, very good point, and a startling point for many people who are not involved in these issues, which is that Jerusalem does not have a statutory outline plan. The last plan was statutorily approved in 1959. Now, there have been different mayors who've been, you know, less sensitive or more sensitive to the unique character of Jerusalem. What's happened under Moshe Leon, essentially, is that there's a lot of pinpoint planning. That means a developer comes to the municipality, says, I want to build this there. And then the municipality kind of has a think, and it does compare it to what's around and what have you. But there's no contextualizing it within some kind of overall vision for the city. And this is what's happening in many, many places. There's towers going up, as you know, all over the place, like mushrooms after the rain. The story of the now that's at the moment at the District Planning Committee. They will have to hear the objections and consider what to do. The Lupine Hill, so-called because many years ago, some very inspired person scattered lupine seeds, and it's since become covered in carpets of blue lupins in the spring and draws, I don't know, probably hundreds of thousands of people in the spring. It's also a hill. It's in southeast Jerusalem, incredible views down to the Dead Sea, across to the Old City, the mountains of Moab, Jordan, really a very, very special place. Straddles a Palestinian neighborhood and a Jewish neighborhood, serves as a kind of outdoor lung and community center and meeting place. And the Israel police wants to build a massive police station there. After a massive campaign by residents from both, you know, the Palestinian and the Jewish communities, there was an agreement to freeze the plan and look for alternatives last August. The reason is that the current police station is on a site owned by the supermarket mogul Rami Levy, who wants to build a hotel and residential buildings there. So it actually has to move by the end of, I think it's 2026. The idea was to consider options, including integrating it into the hotel complex somehow. But in November, the police actually informed the local residents that it was back on to be on the hill, but it was only formally announced the day after the municipal elections, which the residents say is a little bit smelly. So the residents are now having to, you know, decide what to do. This is going to be a very large building with bright flashlights and perimeter fencing and an antenna. And even if you'll be able to see the view over all of that, it certainly won't be the same. So it's another case of watch this space. And hopefully by our next podcast, I'll be able to tell you what's been happening with the cable car.
Ah, okay. We'll look forward to that. So, okay. So thank you both, Manny and Sue, for your updates. They were very informative. That's for sure.
Thank you.
Bye.
And thanks for listening to this episode of The Daily Briefing. Stay tuned for tomorrow's installment. This episode is produced by The Podwaves. If you have comments about this or any other podcasts, always feel free to email us, podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until next time, have yourselves a good day and take care.